Pacific Standard Time. This is KOWS LP, Cows Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm, bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cows Community Radio thanks Pernuski Chatham for their generous support. Pernuski Chatham provides environmental engineering, solutions from science through construction. For more information, see www.pcz.com or call them at area code 707-824-4600. We would also like to offer this public service announcement. Food for Thought is located in Forestville and is a nonprofit grassroots organization dedicated to meeting the nutritional needs of persons living with or affected by AIDS-HIV disease in Sonoma County. For more information, you can reach them on the web at fftfoodbank.org or call them at area code 707-887-1647. All right. Well, we'll be returning to the show after a short musical break. During the break, you will be listening to Vadana Trayi from Ravi Shankar, Chants from India. This is a CD produced by George Harrison. We will be right back. This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick, the Mystical Positivist. My normal co-host, Rob Schmidt, director of Tayu Meditation Center, will not be joining me at least for the beginning of the interview. He may be here later in the show, but he had to step away for some personal business. But we're going to have a very interesting show ahead of us today. Our guest on the phone is Prasad Paul Duffy, an internationally known spiritual teacher, author, filmmaker, and radio host. Prasad Paul Duffy has devoted his life to the awakening of humanity and has facilitated hundreds of workshops, retreats, and private sessions for thousands of participants from around the world. Prasad traveled to India in 1995 and met his teacher Papaji, a direct disciple of the great Indian sage Ramana Maharshi. Since then, Prasad has been inspiring people wherever he goes to remember their true nature and to live in freedom in their daily lives. He is the author of Dancing as the Infinite, The Freedom of Our True Self, an ebook available from Amazon.com. And Prasad currently lives in Los Angeles, California, where he leads group satsangs and offers individual sessions, as well as makes conscious films and promotes conscious music to help uplift humanity and elevate our world consciousness. So Prasad Paul Duffy, welcome to The Mystical Positivist. Are you there? Prasad, are you with us? Hello? Well, we may have a little connection problem here. Prasad, are you there? Hello? Well, let me give him a call back. We'll just be just a second here. In the meantime, I'm going to put on another track from those wonderful chants that we were hearing. Back with Prasad Paul Duffy. Prasad Paul Duffy, welcome to The Mystical Positivist.
Thank you. I love that it's not only mystical, but positive.
Indeed. Well, the wonders of modern technology sometimes get the better of us, so I'm glad we could work things out and get you on here.
Yeah, I'm standing on the beach in Topanga watching sunset.
Oh, that's beautiful.
California. Yes.
All right. Well, one of the things we usually do with the show, since this is really about an in-depth discussion of spiritual practice, spiritual paths, and ideas around that, is we ask our guests to start by giving us a short spiritual biography. And what we're looking for is really, you know, your story about how you came to find your both your path and how you met your teacher and what the influences were that got you to the position that you're in today.
It's always an interesting question because it's almost like the one who woke up no longer exists, you know? And and the awakening is only happening now. You know, I have to preface it by saying that. So
right.
The persona who woke up is kind of like Siddhartha, you know, before the Buddha. He was a prince, he was a king. But in awakening, we let go of that identification with ourselves as the past. And we awaken, really, in each moment. So, but when I do access my biography, if you will, the Paul Duffy part of Prasad Paul Duffy, like many of your listeners, I was a seeker. I think it really came from my past life of suffering and achieving some level of awakening. We can talk about that later if you want. And so I feel like I came into this world as a kind of bodhisattva, but with no context in which to be received or understood. So I felt like I didn't fit in to the society, the Irish Catholic family from Boston that I was raised in.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt disconnected with that and was always searching for a home, a community, even though they're a very loving family, you know. So I was always searching for something more. So in high school, of course, I searched through weed and psychedelics and had glimpses, you know, mini samadhis, if you will. That there was something beyond this limited perception that I perceived as Paul Duffy. And then I would seek meditation classes. Certainly, with reading the Buddha's teachings, I love the book Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. That touched me a lot when I was a young man. And then I got involved as becoming a therapist, helping people deal with their suffering. But it's still, there was this longing to really to confirm the glimpses that I had seen under the influences of those particular medicines and meditational moments. And so I read a book called Wake Up and Roar, which is a collection of talks by Papaji from Lucknow. You heard of him?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so when I opened the page, I read just the first lines of the preface, and I fell into this deep samadhi beyond anything I had tasted before. And it lasted about 6 hours. I was on Hawaii at the time, Kauai. And that kind of finished the doubt, you know. It's like somehow I came to the place where I am now, even though I was still a doubting young man at the time. Not even young. I was in my early 30s. And it still took me a couple more years to go to India and see Papaji, because I was still working as a therapist with people around the country. But when I finally did go, it was not what I expected, of course. I kept trying to get him to... hold on, helicopter. I kept trying to get him to look at me, you know, to confirm me, somehow create a kind of transmission, you know, that I'd read about. And he wouldn't. It was fantastic. He would just look away, you know. He would just give me a little bit of a glimpse and then look away. And I finally left Lucknow and went to Northern India. And ended up working with the children up there in the Rishikesh area. They were the untouchable families, you know, in the caste system. Beautiful, beautiful children. And I just disappeared into service, into seva. And I would spend my mornings helping, you know, open clinics and teach school and just love these open-hearted children. And then I'd spend my afternoon sitting by the Ganga River, which became a great teacher, because I would watch the river go by and I would see that the river was always changing, but always the same, you know? It appeared exactly the same, but it was fresh water coming through each moment, each second. And I learned to get still in that meditation. And that's Papaji's main teaching, keep quiet. You know, we could talk about that when we get into practice.
Okay.
And then the funny thing is that my visa expired, and I went, I had resistance to go back to Papa G because my ego had resistance because, you know, he wasn't giving it the attention that it wanted. And so I went to other, you know, to governmental, means to be able to extend my visa, to be able to continue working with the kids. And none of them allowed for it. And even, I don't know if you know, if you've traveled over there, even Nepal, which usually you go to Nepal for a week or two, extend your visa and come back, that shut down that particular program at the time. So it was like the universe conspired to force me to go back to Lucknow. And I showed up at Satsang, and I was sitting in like the first or second row. And someone was reading a book that they had written about Papaji, and he wasn't giving discourse, and he wasn't interacting with anyone. He was just kind of giving his energy to that person. And I was sitting right behind that person. And at one point, his glance just kind of wandered over to my eyes, and the whole room turned to light, and everything disappeared. And what it was I had been looking for kind of melted in that. Because that's another one of his main teachings, you know, call off the search. You are already that which you seek.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, he, you know, I wrote a question and I sat in front of him, and he was like, oh, I was told about you, you know, because I had been working with one of his other disciples who was running the organization for the Indian children, the NGO. And he acknowledged me, you know, for the work I was doing. And somehow I knew that that was my teacher because he sent me back to work with the kids.
Hmm.
And it was a confirmation of, again, another thing we can talk about as a past, you know, selfless service. Because the ego wants to wake up. The ego wants enlightenment because it thinks it will get what it wants and life will be happy and it'll be heaven, you know, this idea that really needs to be let go of as part of the path to allow one's consciousness to come through, you know, to get out of your way with the ego's demands and ideas and expectations, and to be quiet enough, like Papaji says, to be quiet enough to recognize what already is. You know, so that's kind of a shortened version of an epic story.
Well, I appreciate that. That's a great way to get started here. One of the things I thought was interesting in what you described was that you had certain experiences, certain like samadhi-like experiences when you first read a book that had talks by Papaji, and even in the darshan that you were describing, where the whole room filled with light, I get the impression from what you're saying that yes, that was what you were looking for, but it wasn't. Am I correct in having heard you say that you weren't done at that point, in a sense, that there was still, in one sense, you realized yourself in as a perfect being, but there was still the manifestation of the egoic mechanism that was still present at that time. Is that?
Oh. Yeah, that, I mean, you could say that for sure. In the moment of everything turning to light, there was none.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also, there was no devices either. Like, I didn't do anything to achieve it. That was, I think, the lesson of that. I didn't take any medicines. I didn't meditate through Vipassana, you know, breath work. I didn't do anything to achieve it. I just had let go of it. And I just happened to be sitting behind the guy reading, and he just happened to look at me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and now my understanding, you know, it's an Advaita tradition that I come from. And so in Advaita, which is non-duality, there is no other. So it's my own self looking at my own self. Papaji didn't give me anything, you know. There is no teacher, no disciple, in a kind of Zen way, you understand?
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. The representation. I guess, and that's something kind of interesting to get into, because part of the reason that I asked about the process was that, on the one hand, there's a process or there's a trajectory of a body-mind mechanism or organism that is an expression of being that goes through certain experiences and comes to a place where we might say, to use a term I think you might resonate with, you becomes more workable with respect to the creation. And at the same time, the truth of beingness is that there's no differentiation. I find that an interesting paradox, or I find that an interesting, you know, like two contradictory things to hold at once. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about it with your thoughts on is that sometimes the mind being what it is, when we have a representation that seems, you know, internally consistent, like everything's one or there's no guru and there's no teacher, the mind can go with that. But that's not necessarily reality. That's simply the mind going with a representation of reality. I've often had the sense that reality is more complex or nuanced than this way or that way. Does that make sense?
Yes, of course. It's both ways or no ways, of course. And these words for certain listeners who are in their minds will just sound like concepts, but I live from them, mm-hmm. you know? And what you're talking about is, in a way, the Diamond Sutra, you know, emptiness is form and form is emptiness, right?
Yeah.
So the emptiness is when the ego disappears and we're in that oneness, that samadhi, everything's light or what have you. But form is where we move through this reality, which is, you know, a kind of relative reality. Some call it the Maya or a dream. We can get into that too later. But for me, I think what you're pointing to is you have this peak experience of awakening where the mind drops. And many people have had it with me since, you know, where I've held the space for them to, through self-inquiry or through meditation, for them to realize that the thought that they perceive themselves as, you know, the ego that they think they have been all these years is nothing but a thought,
mm-hmm.
and to let it go and fall back into emptiness, the emptiness the Buddha spoke of, and to experience a nirvana in that stillness, that perfection of that already is, that beingness that you speak of, while at the same time, then how do you live from that place? Do you stay in a cave, you know, and just meditate all day like Papaji's guru, Ramana Maharshi? That's what he did.
Right.
And the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, you know. But I feel that once we taste it, the work is the integration process. And not all people would agree with me. Not all teachers would agree with me. But this is what I'm bringing to the table, is the integration process of the form. Not that the form needs to be enlightened, but the form needs to be purified, if you will, so that it is quiet enough to yield to consciousness, to get out of its own way and allow existence to play through it, to create through it. Another beautiful paradox is, you know, we are the creator, but we are also our creation.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about that as well. I'd love to talk about that, you know, how we create our reality through our consciousness.
Yeah, I just want to acknowledge that I'm right with you with what you were saying. One of the favorite expressions from a teacher I admire very much who had his Maha Samadhi a little over a year ago, a man named Lee Lozowick. I don't know if you know who he is.
No.
But he was a disciple of Yogi Ram Sarat Kumar, who was the godchild of Tiruvannamalai. He was a beggar guru. But Lee would say, Lee was very savvy with Western expression, and he also has had this wonderful crustiness, but he would say that, you know, it's really easy to enlighten someone in an evening. That, you know, you can do that in all through various ways, through various experiences, Shaktipat, things like that. What the real challenge is actually integrating that realization into a lifetime of practice.
Yeah.
And so he considered himself a tantric teacher, and his students are among the most impeccable and you know, people with the highest integrity that I know in terms of their ability to even hold a community together after his passing, to realize that you know, the work doesn't stop, that there's a constant, in a sense, vigilance, or there is a perfecting that is expressed in the duality of life, even though it is a reflection of the non-duality of life. And it's that interplay of the two, you know, that is the expression of the creation.
That's it. As you just said it so beautifully, that's exactly where I'm coming from. And it's not what you're describing. The mind can hear as duality, but it is not. It is the embracing of the two apparently opposing ideas. They're not really ideas, but life paths, if you will.
Right.
But they're not. They are integrated fully when one is awake, and you see it, that everything rises from nothing. And like, I'm watching the ocean right now, you know? That's the metaphor many masters use. And the wave rises from the ocean and falls back into the ocean. So when the wave is rising, it still is part of the ocean. And these forms, these personalities that we are, really momentarily in terms of eternity, are the waves, but we are the ocean. And this is the doorway to awakening, is to really embrace who we are as the ocean in every moment as we're playing out our karma, if you will, our dharma even, as the wave, you know?
Right.
This is one of the first steps of enlightenment, you know? And I love when I hear someone like you speak from this place. It touches my heart deeply, this recognition that, you know, we know we're both waves in the same ocean.
Indeed. Well, I have a background of part of my own life story is training in the world of physics. And in quantum mechanics, there's this notion of the wave-particle duality. And the reconciliation is that, you know, matter, light, isn't really a wave, and it really isn't a particle. It really depends on what question you're asking in the experiment. So if you look at it in one way, it'll appear like a particle. If you look at it in another way, it'll look like a wave. And I often find for myself that the duality, non-duality, polarity is an example of this kind of complementarity, where sometimes it's relevant to live in duality, sometimes it's relevant to live in unduality, but the truth is larger and embraces both of those perceptual modes.
But I think non-duality does, or is intended to embrace both. It's like non-duality, even though it's weird because it says non. So, you know, if we use the word oneness, the positive idea of it, you know, yoga, as you must know, means union. You know, if we were to use the idea of oneness or unity consciousness, is what I've been calling it lately, then that embraces both duality, like the yin-yang does, you know?
Right.
It's like it embraces. So the word non-duality is actually a kind of misleading term because it gives the sense that it is part of the duality polarity. And
right.
It's not.
Well, let me.
What you just said.
Right. Let's return to. I need to do a quick break here, and then we'll return to that question. So you all are listening to the Mystical Positivist on KOWS LP 107.3 FM, and streaming live at www.kows.fm. Cows Community Radio thanks Minnie Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Minnie Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Minnie Rivers carries fine loose-leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Minnie Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street, Suite 101 in Sebastopol. You can reach them at area code 707-829-8871, email info@minnierivers.com, or visit them on the web at www.minnieriversbooks.com. You are listening to The Mystical Positivist, and our guest on the air today is Prasad Paul Duffy. Prasad is an internationally known spiritual teacher, author, filmmaker, and radio host, and has facilitated workshops, retreats, and private sessions for thousands of participants from around the world. He's also the author of Dancing as the Infinite, The Freedom of Our True Self. So, Prasad, you were saying just before the break that the term non-duality, even though it sort of paradoxically has a negation in it, encompasses this larger sense. And the reason I expressed the things that the way I did, and this is partly maybe my a sense of observation or critique I have of some manifestations of non-dual spiritual rap. I'll call it rap as opposed to a deep integrated practice, is that it is that people can get a hold of an idea like there is no practice, or there is, you know, there's, you know, I'm perfect as I am, and there's no separation between you know, me or anyone else. There's no teacher, there's no student, etc., etc. And at one level, I can't argue with those statements, but when they become the province of the egoic mechanism, they can often become a buffer against which one ceases to strive in a particular way or to seek in a particular way that I guess, in my own experience, I found as a necessary tension for an ultimate realization process to become integrated.
Well, I agree with you. I call that spiritual bypass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the words strive and seek are just a little bit also misleading.
Right.
Whereas the word integration, for me, works the best. So let's put it this way. Once an aspirant wakes up and recognizes their true nature as non-dual consciousness, if you will, pure awareness in which all thoughts rise and fall, and when one meditates, one glimpses this, if you sit, you know, long enough and become still enough. And so let's say that realization happens, or with a teacher, the Darshan or Shaktipat, as you said, can give it, you know. And certainly I acknowledge the psychedelic aspect of it, because a lot of the younger generation glimpse that way.
Right.
And I'm reaching out to them because they're our future. But ultimately, even when somebody, quote-unquote, wakes up, and also, they even start teaching their spiritual rap, as you say. The integration process, to me, is the practice. It's when the practice is no longer seeking or striving to attain anything, but is more the vigilance, as you pointed to, of just maintaining or allowing existence, your own creation. Because we are existence and we are our creation. See, we're the subject and the object, right? This is what we discover in meditation. We're the witness, but we're also the thoughts rising within it.
Mm-hmm.
The emptiness is form and form is emptiness, right? As the Buddha shows us. So it's the embracing of that and kind of, that's why originally I was Prasad and I'd let go of Paul Duffy. And it sounds funny to hear you say my full name, because all of the previous radio interviews I've ever done, it was always Prasad, you know? And Prasad Paul Duffy is the integration work that I've been doing of the last few years of really welcoming back my creation, welcoming back the ego who suffered and who was wounded and who was shame-based. And I want to speak of that a little bit as part of the practice, was shame-based. And so as part of awakening, I detached from the identification with my ego, with Paul Duffy, and I saw that I was bigger than the wave of Paul Duffy, which comes and goes, and I surrendered to the ocean and kind of melted into it as a drop of water, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the integration, now it's been 15 years since that moment, you know? So, and that's why it's funny, some of these younger teachers, these young upstarts in the Advaita movement, you know, are very popular, because they do teach what you said. Oh, you're perfect. Don't touch it. You don't need to do anything. You know, stop working on yourself. All of these deep Advaita truths that you and I both know. But for the mind, when they grab hold of it, they actually might then stop the process of awakening on some level or postpone it because they are no longer vigilant.
Right.
And then the ego grabs the spiritual truth and uses it to justify its existence, to postpone its surrender, and to perpetuate its misidentifications, but it's just becomes a different one, spiritual identifications, if you will.
Yeah.
So I'm 100% with you. The vigilance for me, and that's why Papaji's Keep Quiet is a great one, you know. It's just to how would I say, I've been working on welcoming back the personality and the form, but not giving emphasis or power to its misidentified needs and desires.
Got it.
And so it's what Krishnamurti would call choiceless awareness, where you're just moving through the world as the world is moving through you. Like, you know, that's the thing you realize. It's just like when you're dreaming at night, you know? You recognize that this life, this reality is a dream and of our creation. So it's moving through us, but we are moving through it as well, through these body-mind mechanisms.
Right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say on the Krishnamurti quote that I sometimes feel that a different way of expressing that is, from my own experience, is that actually choice is the thing. It is choiceful awareness in that the vigilance is the conscious choice not to identify with the egoic mechanism.
Beautiful.
And so yeah. There is choicelessness in one sense, and I appreciate that from Krishnamurti, but there's an active aspect of this, and that's the sense I have of vigilance, is that it is necessary, and this is to me, you know, what I think about when I think about a term like spiritual integrity, is to embody that choice as frequently as possible, and then when we don't make that choice, to recognize that and to confront that truth, not in a sense of judgment, but simply to be real about it and to move on.
And you know, at the risk of sounding Advaita speak, who is making the choice? I mean, that's where the self-inquiry comes in, you know? Who is making the choice? If the choice is seen clearly in the emptiness of pure awareness, and it's a way that it becomes our practice, right? That's what mm-hmm. you showed us with. The practice of right action, as the Buddha says, but then you hear the words right action, and it's like, okay, then there's wrong action. That doesn't compute for those who are in the Advaita realization, right?
Right.
It's right and wrong. It's duality. So what is right action? Who defines the right? Who defines this? So I think this initial choice you're speaking of is the choice to perhaps surrender to what is each moment.
Mm-hmm.
To say yes, which, you know, seems to be the opposite of no for some people, but no, saying no to your addictions, for instance, is a yes, you know?
Right,
so
exactly.
Saying yes to the moment, which is the tantric way of this master you mentioned. This is very much a way, once you wake up, that's why I don't encourage at all the monk's path of repression. I think there's a period for it that's useful, just like the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. But that was because he had been a king, you know. And so the middle way, of course, is what he pointed to. So in a way, this is what we're talking about, isn't it? The middle way of embracing both. That I am consciousness, and everything that rises in consciousness is perfect. Yet, I am also in charge of this body-mind mechanism of my creation, and it can't just go around doing whatever the hell it wants to.
Right. Well, I think there's something more that I see that is a fusion of that as well, and that's there's a unique opportunity of being embodied in a human form.
Yes.
That is, I think, perhaps unique to our particular realm or, you know, whatever form human takes, you know, in the cosmos, but that the possibility of integrating the non-dual or the universal with the suffering of the particular creates a kind of a personalness. That, you know, when I go to the center of my heart, my most intimate moment, you know, the thing that is most me in a subjective sense, a pure energetic subjective me, I realize that is God. And that is, it's the bringing together of the universal into the particular to be embodied with that, that is the miracle. That's like the amazing thing to me.
Yes. And that's what, when we went to break, that's what I wanted to say. The unity consciousness, or the positive way of saying non-dual, is love. That's the word that, and we're not talking about the action of loving. We're talking about love as our true nature, love as another word for God, God consciousness. And so that, to me, points to, in a way, the practice, if you will, or the vigilance. And it really begins with self-love,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I'd like to talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, please.
The practice and integration is that I mentioned the shame earlier. This deep sense of unworthiness that a lot of egos that I have worked with, or a lot of personalities that I've worked with over the years, and of course a reflection of my own, because I told you at the beginning of the interview, you know, this sense of not fitting in,
right.
I think is really what kind of created that. And I just know that until one embraces themselves as good, or loves themselves, including love their ego. I have a chapter in my book called Love Your Ego to Death, you know. and until that happens, all of the spiritual seeking and sitting with teachers and what have you is really escapism for the ego from that pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it over and over and over. So a lot of the advice of teachers that I used to travel in circles, and some of them are famous with, you know, best-selling authors,
right.
They would judge my work because I'm much more aligned with what you're saying, Stuart, that we had to do, you know, after they had the glimpse, in order for them to integrate it, they had to go back and do some therapy, if you will, but it's not really the healing work of just letting go of the hooks in the past that had created this strong misidentification on the subconscious level. And so, unlike the Buddha, who was a prince, you know, he was protected from all of this. And then his heart went out when he saw the suffering in others, if I recall from the story. You know, the people's own suffering is what has often driven them to seek truth. I remember being in Lucknow in India around Papaji and saying, I don't care about enlightenment. I just want to put an end to suffering. And the suffering is actually the motivation for many people to wake up. And so until one comes to terms with the truth, which is most of that suffering is self-created through this core belief that they, meaning their ego, is not good enough. And so even I said how I kind of let go of Paul Duffy, and now I've done the work of reintegrating him and loving all of me.
Right.
All my creation.
I'm reminded of the ox herding pictures. Are you familiar with that in the Zen tradition? Where there's a boy that's chasing an ox, and it's a metaphor for the enlightenment process. And at some point in this process, everything disappears. There's nothing. You know, there's no mountains, there's no ox, there's no anything. And eventually the ox comes back, the mountains come back, and at the very end, the boy is riding the ox and returning to the marketplace with open arms.
Oh, I love that image. And it really, I mean, we talked about love being a positive expression of this awakening. And so the self-love we're talking about is really not just the love of the ego, but the love of the self, which is another word for God. Ramana Maharshi and Yogananda in India, they were contemporaries of the same time, about 100 years ago. They called it self-realization for a reason, you know, that God is not outside of us. So that's really, you know, the real symptom of awakening that I'm bringing, mm-hmm. as well, is that God is not outside of us. Another chapter in my book is called Come Out of the Closet as God. You know?
There's a good one.
God is not outside of us, folks. The religions, the popes, the kings have been telling you this as a way to disempower you, much like the current political climate today, which we can talk about later if you want to. But it's a way to disempower people to think that they need to rely on some God up in the clouds outside of them who is going to tell them that they're worthy or not based on their actions, and they pray outside of them, Jesus, whoever, Buddha, even a lot of Buddhists. People ask me, are you a Buddhist? I said, no, I'm a Buddha. You know, are you a Christian? No, I'm a Christ. This is truly what I'm bringing in, to my flavor of awakening. And it's somewhat controversial to traditional people, but those traditions become just another concept, like we spoke of, that they use to postpone their realization of who we are as God, as love, as the self. And so the shame of the core belief that I'm not good enough is what I feel perpetuates that myth, that lie,
right,
of looking for Papa or Santa Claus outside of yourself, who's going to give you the magic bullet and wake you up and give you the blessing. And you know, religions have, and gurus have made a lot of money through the years on this misidentification. So I'm just saying to anyone who's listening right now that this is what we're speaking of, and I hear you're coming from this place, Stuart, from your own flavor. And that's the beautiful thing, is everybody wakes up to their own flavor. Each wave is unique, but it's
right,
all ocean. And this is the celebration, and this is where the love comes from. And now that I'm loving not only the self with the big S, but also the self with the small S, my creation, people feel it when I'm walking. It's like it's not just sitting in satsang, in formal satsang, where I'm completely empty and transmitting, but it's every day wherever I am, and I'm in Hollywood, I'm in LA, you know, and just transmitting that love, and I realize, you know, that the work is helping people heal their wounded self so that then they can get to a place where they can keep quiet and realize.
Do you think that, do you see that work as primarily psychological, or do you see it as, is there something deeper?
Yeah, I think that psychological sounds like the realm of the mind and psyche, you know, and all that. I see it as a heart journey, you know. I see it as emotional. I see it as those emotional wounds are where we get stuck. And they can be as simple as a little, that's why any parents who are listening right now, just without getting neurotic, be aware that if you lose your temper with your child or you power trip your child in some way thinking that, you know best, those are where the wounds happen. Of course, someone who neglects or abuses their child is much worse. But I've worked with people who had loving parents, and my parents were loving as well. But it was that they were unconsciously dominating the child and giving them a sense that they were not capable or good enough in that moment. And then the child kind of grabs onto it and build the rest of their experience on that core belief.
Right.
You know, and so I think it, I don't like, you know, Papaji used to make fun of therapists, so I gave up therapy for a while, leading therapy for a while, and just would do the advice of satsang. But then I would do workshops and breath work. It's really, it's the journey of the heart where we reclaim the part of ourself that we've denied, that we embrace the inner child, if you will, of the ego who's been wounded as a way of letting it go. So cognitive behavioral therapy, it turns out, is kind of the process that I organically move towards, where I like for the person I work with to really be working with themselves, and I'm just the coach guiding them, which is the true guru anyway. The true guru sees everyone as awake. I see everyone as awake, but we're just reflecting them in that place. And if they can't see it yet, then we have to do whatever we can to move the clouds away. And right now the sun has come from beyond the clouds and it's beginning to approach the ocean, the setting, and the light is shining. And that's it. It's like the shining light is the self, the God self, the loved self that we are. And the clouds are the mind or the shameful core beliefs that just need to be cleared away with love and compassion.
So, do you find that when someone is introduced to this, to when they have the radical realization that, in fact, what they've taken to be their life is simply an interpretation of a set of experiences that have nothing to do with who they are as a being, is that sufficient? You know, this is the question I'm struggling with in terms of integration. That, like, for instance, in my experience, there's certain things that I call the low hanging fruit that drop away instantly, and it's like a blast. And then there's deeper seated habit patterns that are realized in my body that may even have something to do with my body type, you know, my genetic heritage, but just habit patterns of how I react or how I contract in certain events that require a different category of attention than simply realizing, oh yeah, I was identified with that.
Yeah, so first of all, I love how you express yourself, you know, your understanding of the process. But it's like, again, misidentification with the ego, to me, is what obscures our realization with our true self, when people think that's who they are.
Right.
And so that radical awakening that can happen with a teacher or just, you know, sometimes a near-death experience or what have you, terrible suffering can create it if you know how to, if you have a guide to help you through that. Yet then it's like, then how do you move through the world? Again, do you just sit in a cave or how do you interact? So as you interact with your creation, it upgrades to meet your own shift in consciousness. But then there are the samsaras from the past that come back for you to integrate, as we've been saying. And so part of it is they have to be embraced before they can be let go. This is the cornerstone of the therapy that I do. It's like, love your ego to death, you know, embrace
right.
first and then let it go. Because who's judging it? That's just more mind wanting to get rid of that part of ourselves.
Right. Yeah, that's the tradition that I grew up in is both, I had a teacher and that teacher had a teacher, but it's a kind of a rogue tradition that's similar to what's called the fourth way tradition or the Gurdjieff work.
Yeah. Gurdjieff, sure.
And though most of the official or formal practitioners of Gurdjieff I find very somber and actually enmeshed in the kind of shame that you're describing, but my own teacher's focus was that, you know, he would call the ego structure the android because it was sort of looks like a human, acts like a human, but it's not quite human. But it was about loving that. It was about putting full attention on it. The practice of self-observation was to hold a space, to hold a presence to see it. And it really is like loving it for what it is, but in that love comes the freedom because you don't have to be it.
Well, Papaji used to say, if you look at the I thought, you are not the I thought. So the first step, of course, for all those listening, it's of meditation, is witnessing. Witnessing your thoughts. So no matter how compelling they are, no matter how painful they are, no matter how real they may appear, especially as emotion, that's why doing the emotional work is crucial.
Yeah.
Because that's where, you know, it gets locked in as reality because it feels so real. It feels so real. But lately I've just been seeing people accelerating in their realization that it's the past. You know, it's like, it's the past. Let it go and be here now. This is the power of now, is that we recognize that that happened to us in the past. We recognize the tendency of the mind to rise. We recognize the desires and expectations on the moment, but we don't believe any of them. This is why I say in my book, never mind your mind. You know, it's like, they're all going to rise until ultimately you're very quiet, you know, perhaps, and that might even feel like being dead. I don't know, you know, but ultimately they're going to rise. It's how much we believe in it, how much we engage in it, how much it runs this android that we are moving through this creation in. That's the integration process, I feel.
Right.
That's where the Four Noble Truths are assisting people. That's what interests appears both of you and I, that just to having that awakening and then saying, oh, how about this one? Have you heard this one? There is no doer. I'm not the doer. And so they just indulge their behavior in any way with no taking no responsibility for it because they're not the doer.
Hey.
That's a big Advaita spiritual bypass right there.
Yeah.
No, you're 100% responsible for every action. You're 100% responsible for every perception. There is no victim. Do not point the finger at anyone else. That everything you see is your perception. And so if it's not working out for you, shift. shift your thought process. Drop the, and that's why keeping quiet allows you to drop your thoughts and return to the breath, or return to emptiness. And then actually what rises from there is the heart-centered space that you've been speaking of, is that love that creates a whole different reality than the patterns that you have been perpetuating through the mind's wounded or just past belief systems.
Right. One of the more powerful, it's not exactly a practice, it's more like a way of looking at things that I got from my teacher that I worked with and sort of integrated, was the idea that if you open yourself to the universe to be awakened, and that is what you're there for, that the experiences in one's life begin to conform to showing you and reflecting and mirroring you exactly the deep-seated attachments and identifications that you were describing earlier. That, and the marvelous thing about that frame of mind is that it was the quickest way for me to suddenly, you know, like, have to be responsible for everything. Like, all of my experiences all of a sudden were, I was responsible for it. You know, it was, no matter what happened, it was, the universe was showing this to me for a reason, that so for me to look at the reactivity that came up within me in conjunction with whatever the particular event happened to be, whether it was a workspace event or my relationship with my mom or something like that.
Exactly. That's another chapter of my book, is Fall in Love with Truth. To make truth and freedom your priority. Once you declare, once an aspirant says, I want to be free, and especially if they find a true teacher, you know, then the universe will conspire for that. And then, like we're speaking of now, the integration process is the resolve to stay awake. Now, the universe will not give your ego what it wants. I'm here in, you know, L.A. for the last few years because I have a few feature films now, but I have one I wrote called Freedom High about young people's awakening, and through experimentation with psychedelics, and then they find the true path through meditation. And I was really, I'd retired again from teaching, just to kind of move into this world, just because it was something that I'd gone to college for, and I felt that it would be an effective way to reach a lot of young people with, the truth. And but my butt got kicked down here, because nothing happened as quickly or in the way that I expected. And so those expectations created a sense of suffering. Not true suffering, because I never forgot who I am.
Right.
Never, ever.
But boy, do I get that, because I still work in the business world, during the day to support the teaching work that we do and the various projects we have. And it's wonderful. It is absolutely wonderful in that regard. Hey, I have to take a quick break at the hour, so bear with me here. The time is 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is KOWSLP, Cal's Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial, and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. You are listening to The Mystical Positivist. Cal's Community Radio thanks John G. Blair for his generous support. John G. Blair is Occidental's own award-winning professional photographer. John offers portrait, wedding, and commercial photography services. He can be reached at area code 707-874-2399, or find him on the web at www.jgblairphoto.com. By way of public service announcement, we ask you if you can become a Sonoma County Parks member. With the budget cuts threatening closure of many of our state parks, you can help the Sonoma County Park System survive by becoming a member. For more information, go to the web at www.sonomacountyparks.org or call at 707-565-2041. We will return to The Mystical Positivist after a short musical break, and we'll continue our conversation with our guest today, Prasad Paul Duffy. Prasad, Paul, Duffy, say that many times. Prasad is an internationally known spiritual teacher, author, filmmaker, and radio host, and has facilitated workshops, retreats, and private sessions for thousands of participants from around the world. He's the author of Dancing as the Infinite, The Freedom of Our True Self. So we'll return to the show after a short musical break. During the break, you'll be listening to Sarve Shaam from Ravi Shankar, Chants from India, a CD produced by George Harrison. We'll be right back.
Sarvesham Svastir Bhavatu.